ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय Reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, chapter 73. Start of the new chapter, so we'll just read over the introduction. This chapter relates how Lord Sri Krishna, after freeing the kings imprisoned by Jarasandha, mercifully gave them his audience and bestowed royal gifts upon them. When Lord Krishna freed the 20,800 kings Jarasandha had imprisoned, they immediately fell to the ground to pay him obeisances. Then they stood with joined palms and began to pray to him. Seeing their imprisonment as an act of mercy by the Lord to smash their false pride, the kings prayed only to be granted whatever would facilitate their perpetual remembrance of his lotus feet. The Lord assured the kings that their prayer would be fulfilled. He instructed them, Worship me by performing Vedic sacrifices and protect your subjects in accordance with the principles of religion. Fixing your minds upon me, beget progeny, and remain always equipoised in happiness and distress. Thus, at the end of your lives, you will surely attain me. Lord Krishna then saw to it that the kings were properly bathed and dressed, and he had Sahadeva offer them flower garlands, sandalwood pulp, fine clothing, and other things suitable for kings. After having them adorned with jewels and golden ornaments, he seated them on chariots and sent them off to their respective kingdoms. In accordance with the orders the Lord had given them, they began to carry out their various duties once again. Lord Krishna, Bhima and Arjuna then departed for Indraprastha, where they met with King Yudhishthira and related to him everything that had happened. Text number 1 to 6, it's number 1 on the board, which we'll chant together. Shri Shuka Uvacha,
Shri Shuka Uvacha,
Ayute Dvi Shant, Ayute dvi shantanyasto,
Ayute dvi shantanyasto,
Niruda yuri nirjita,
Niruda yuri nirjita,
Te nirgata girid oyam,
Te nirgata girid oyam,
Malena malavasasa,
Malena malavasasa,
Shri Shuka Uvacha,
Shri Shuka Uvacha,
Ayute dvi shantanyasto,
Ayute dvi shantanyasto,
Nirudha yudhi nirjita,
Nirudha yudhi nirjita,
Te nirgata giridronyam,
Te nirgata giridronyam,
Malena malavasasa,
Malena malavasasa,
Shri Shuka Uvacha,
Shri Shuka Uvacha,
Ayute dvi shatanyashto,
Ayute dvi shatanyashto,
Niruda yudhi nirjita,
Niruda yudhi nirjita,
Te nirgata giridronyam,
Te nirgata giridronyam,
Malena malabhasasa,
Malena malabhasasa,
Shri Shuka Uvacha,
Ayute dvi shantanyasto, Shasto. Niruda Yudhi Nirjita. Nirgata Giridronya. Malina Malavasata. Shri Shukra Uvacha. Ayukte Dvesha Tanyasto. Niruta Yudhi Nirjita. Nirgata Giridronya. Malina Malavasata. Translation by Disciples of Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. There's five other texts there as well, but we won't chant those. Shukadev Goswami said, Jarasandha had defeated 20,800 kings in combat and thrown them into prison. As these kings emerged from the Giridroni forest, they appeared dirty and shabbily dressed. They were emaciated by hunger, their faces were dried up, and they were greatly weakened by their long imprisonment. The kings then beheld the Lord before them. His complexion was dark blue, like the colour of a cloud, and he wore a yellow silk garment. He was distinguished by the Srivats mark on his chest, his four mighty arms, the pinkest hue of his eyes, which resembled the whorl of a lotus flower. His lovely cheerful face, his gleaming makara earrings, and the lotus club, conch shell, and disc in his hands. A helmet, a jewelled necklace, a golden belt, and golden bracelets and armlets decorated his form, and on his neck he wore both the brilliant, precious Kaustubha gem and garland of forest flowers. The kings seemed to drink his beauty with their eyes, lick him with their tongues, relish his fragrance with their nostrils, and embrace him with their arms. Their past sins now eradicated, the kings all bowed down to Lord Hari, placing their heads at his feet. Text number 7, there's no purport to text number 6. The ecstasy of beholding Lord Krishna, having dispelled the weariness of their imprisonment, the kings stood with joined palms and offered words of praise to that supreme master of the senses. Text number 8. The kings said, obeisances to you, O Lord of the ruling demigods, O destroyer of your surrendered devotees' distress. Since we have surrendered to you, O inexhaustible Krishna, please save us from this terrible material life which has made us so despondent. Text number 9. O Master Madhusudan, we do not blame this king of Magadha, since it is actually by your mercy that kings fall from their royal position, O Almighty Lord. Purport. It is significant that upon seeing Lord Krishna and thus becoming purified of their sins, the kings did not feel any mundane hatred or bitterness towards Jarasandha, who had imprisoned them. Simply by seeing Lord Krishna, the kings came to the position of Krishna consciousness and spoke these verses which show deep spiritual wisdom. Amagana Jamanandasya Jananjana Shalakaya Chakshu Unmulitam Yena Tasma Shri Gurave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Dvaita Gadadha Shiva Sari Gaurabhakta Vrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Ram Hare Ram Rama Rama Hare Hare Mukham Karati Vachalam Pangam Langa Te Girim Yakri Patamahan Lande Shigurum Dinatarinam. So, very wonderful description we're hearing of the sensual experience that the kings are experiencing upon seeing their beloved Sri Krishna, which interestingly enough it appears here that Krishna appeared before them not in his Shama Sundra form with two arms, but with his Vishnu form with four arms. So the kings, upon seeing this form of the Lord, their senses are completely enlivened. This is the potency of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, that he has the ability to attract all living entities to him. And the kings obviously have been locked away in this cave by Jarasandha for a long, long time. This is some of the devious activities that Jarasandha had been performing. Initially he had taken these kings because he wanted to sacrifice them to Lord Shiva. I will please Lord Shiva by offering these 10,800 kings in a sacrifice to you. And this way I shall please you, and in this way you shall give me material benedictions. So Jarasandha is very, very demoniac. Very, very demoniac. It's interesting, actually, if we study Jarasandha, we get a very good insight into the nature and psychology of a demon. We can see that Jarasandha's thinking processes are very much so found today within modern day people of a similar nature. And you see, a good example is one of the leaders in Africa, Idi Amin, used to be a dictator over Uganda, and very, very similar to Jarasandha in his consciousness. He would imprison people who were supposed to be threats to his presidency and commit all sorts of horrible atrocities to them. And it's even rumoured or reported that he would also eat particular body parts of his enemies. Very, very, very demoniac. Very, very asuric consciousness. So this consciousness is found within Jarasandha. But it's interesting to note that at the same time that these people who have a very asuric or demoniac envious consciousness, so envious, completely envious, that they still think that they're nice people. There's a story of a man called, I think his name was Two-Gun Crowley, something like that. He was a criminal in America, maybe in the 50s or 60s, around that time. And he was famed for having two revolvers he'd carry around with him. And he, in cold blood, one time the police were chasing him for murdering people. So the police, or one policeman, was approaching him in a car, not realising who it was. And this Two-Gun Crowley was at the time with his lady friend. So this, upon being disturbed by the police officer while embracing his lady friend, he pulled out one of his revolvers and shot this policeman in cold blood, killed him dead, and got out of the car and then took the policeman's revolver and then shot him again with the policeman's own revolver. So the police obviously were very anxious to capture this criminal, so they began a great manhunt, and they chased him down into a New York apartment, one of the high-rise apartments in New York. And at the time it was, and of course now these things are probably quite common in America, where there's a big manhunt and it's always filmed on television now, and you can watch the media with the helicopters chasing after the car being pursued by 20 policemen, and it looks quite comical, but these things happen quite regularly in the States, you know? And the man gets out of the car and the policemen run after him, and they've all got the guns drawn and approach him, and it's, this is what people like to watch on TV these days, part of their entertainment. So back when this was happening, it was quite an extreme situation. So the police had surrounded this particular building on the rooftops, and they had machine guns and guns, and they began shooting at this apartment that this criminal was hiding within. And he was taking refuge behind a sofa, and they were shooting at him and so forth, and he was shooting back, and he'd been wounded by some of the bullets, and he began writing a letter. I'm not sure if they killed him or if they captured him, but in his letter he began writing that you may all think that I'm a criminal and a very evil person, but actually I'm not that bad. I'm actually not so bad. I'm a wronged man. And this way he wrote a letter saying, oh, I'm not so bad. Yeah, I killed a policeman, and yes, I've done these things, but I'm not that bad. I'm okay. So you can see this is the nature of a demon, is that they can be performing all sorts of atrocities and horrible acts, but at the same time they're all thinking, I'm actually a nice person. Everyone is thinking this way. I'm a nice person. Even though they're completely abominable in their activities, they're still thinking, I'm okay. I'm alright. I'm not such a bad person. So you see, Jarasandha also had this thinking as well, that when Krishna and Arjuna and Bhima approached Jarasandha in the disguise of the Santaka Brahmanas, and they were wishing to fight with Jarasandha, when they revealed their identity, Jarasandha said, what? I have no enemies. I've done nothing wrong. I'm actually a nice person. I'm following Vedic injunctions very nicely. I'm giving charity to the Brahmanas. I'm a great guy. Whereas Jarasandha was completely demoniac. So you can see this nature of the demons coming out very nicely in this description of Jarasandha. In fact, in the Mahabharata, there are further descriptions of Jarasandha's palace when Krishna and Bhima were approaching it. It gave a very brief description in the last chapter in the Srimad Bhagavatam. In the Mahabharata, explains that when Krishna and Arjuna were approaching the kingdom in Magadha, I think it's called the Giridvari fortress, it was known, or the Giridvari palace where Jarasandha was ruling from. It was surrounded by mountain ranges, and one of these mountain ranges was quite tall. So when Krishna and Arjuna and Bhima were approaching, they decided to descend into this fortress from this great mountain range. And when they were coming down, they were causing a great avalanche. All the boulders and things were falling in and causing a big landslide. And also, at the entranceway, Jarasandha had a great drum which was made of the skins of different rakshasas or enemies he'd killed. And it's explained that this great drum, that when it was struck, it would resonate for at least 1 month. 1 month. And Jarasandha would take great pride in his drum, would make sure it was constantly being beaten to ward off his enemies. Aha, just see my drum. This is a demon, like to make their presence known. Just see my prowess and see my power. Behold my mighty drum, be wary of me. I am powerful, I am great, I am the enjoyer. So in this way Jarasandha was relishing his asuric barbs in different ways. So Krishna and Arjuna approached, but they approached, actually, and their approach was more in the form of being an enemy. That is how they were approaching, causing an avalanche, and they apparently they got this drum and they smashed this drum as well. They broke the drum up into many, many pieces, which further enraged Jarasandha. And then they approached Jarasandha, and the Mahabharata explains that at the time they approached Jarasandha, he was performing a Vedic yajna, because some of his priests had seen bad omens, which were showing that there would be ill fate coming to Jarasandha, so they had prescribed that he perform various sacrifices in order to counteract these bad omens. So Jarasandha at the time was performing this yajna, this puja. The fire was blazing, and that is when Krishna and Arjuna and Bhima approached him. And at first it was only Krishna who spoke. He said that we're Brahmanas, but these two other Brahmanas who are with me, Bhima and Arjuna, in disguise of, as the description in the Mahabharata explains, they were disguised as Santaka Brahmanas, which means students finishing off their studies. So Krishna explained that these two other Brahmanas, you know, they actually have taken a vow of silence, but and they won't speak until midnight. So in this way, Krishna began explaining the situation to Jarasandha, that explained very nicely in the previous chapter, that you are a great king, and you should give in charity to Brahmanas. Now, what is it that a king cannot give to people who beg in charity? In this way, Krishna tricked Jarasandha into offering him the fight. They didn't actually come out and explicitly say that we want to fight you, but they put Jarasandha in a position where he had to say yes to whatever it was they were requesting. So they requested Jarasandha for the fight, and as we're reading the previous chapter, Bhima and Jarasandha had a wonderful fight for 28 days, and then Jarasandha was split in half. As we know, Jarasandha was joined together by a lady, Jara, which means an old lady, joined him together. There's a whole story behind that, which probably has been explained in the class various times. So Jarasandha was split in half, and in this way Krishna enthroned his son, I think it was Jayata something, on the throne. He took over from Jarasandha. So Jarasandha was killed, and in this way King Yudhishthira is in a position where he can perform the Rajasuya sacrifice. And also one of Krishna's purposes to going to kill Jarasandha was obviously to free these kings. So through Krishna's activities he performs many goals are achieved by one of Krishna's activities. So Jarasandha being killed meant the Rajasuya sacrifice could be performed and the kings could be freed. And obviously this is taking place because of Uddhava's instructions in previous chapters. We're reading that this is how Uddhava was explaining that King Yudhishthira could perform the Rajasuya sacrifice and the kings could be liberated. So Krishna has wonderfully freed these kings, and we're hearing a description about how after a very, very long imprisonment they were very emaciated. Just like if someone has been put into solitary confinement, sometimes you see pictures of prisoners of war have been placed into solitary confinement for a long period of time, and they come out and they're very bedraggled in their appearance. The face is very drawn in, deep rings under the eyes, very pale complexion, very uncomfortable position to be in, starving. But upon seeing the Lord, they become completely enlivened. All their senses are completely enlivened. Their eyes see the form of the Lord. They can smell the wonderful fragrance coming from Krishna's body. So it's a very sensual experience. Once again, shows that Krishna is a person. Krishna is not impersonal. No, it's not that the king saw a white light and a big effulgence and they became ecstatic. No, it says they saw the form of the Lord, and it gives a very detailed description of the form that they saw of the Lord. His beautiful garments he was wearing, the Srivats mark on his chest, the wonderful garland, wearing the Kastobya gem, wearing a helmet, a jeweled necklace, a golden belt. So these are all descriptions, very, very personal and very, very detailed. So Krishna at all times is a personality, and Krishna has this ability to enliven the senses. It's explained in the Nectar of Devotion, a famous verse that by rendering service to Krishna, who is the master of the senses, then one becomes freed from all false designations, all upadis. Sarva upadi vine muktam tat paridva nimalam hrishikesha hrishikena sovanam bhakti uchite. That by engaging in bhakti, engaging the senses in the service of the master of the senses, then one becomes free of all false designations and the senses become completely enlivened. So this is a very wonderful description of how this is taking place, that upon seeing Krishna, their senses are enlivened, and also they begin to realise that they've been put into this position not as a fault of Jarasandha, but actually they see it as the Lord's mercy. So this is a very wonderful point to meditate upon, how a devotee should see the Lord's mercy, that the Lord's mercy can come in many, many wonderful ways. Of course, generally when something nice is happening to us, we think, oh yes, Krishna is very nice, Krishna is, God is great. I remember visiting a man several months ago about doing some work for him, and he had a very wonderful palatial house, and I said to him, oh, it's a very nice house you have there. He goes, yes, God is great. So this is people's conception of God, that God is giving them nice material facilities. He's giving us nice house, lots of money, nice car, nice family. And these are generally reasons why people approach God for, is to ask for these things. I want these nice material opulences for my enjoyment. But when distress comes, then it goes the other way, doesn't it? It's like, God, why are you doing this to me for? Look how much I've done for you. Now you're making me suffer for. Why are you doing this to me for? There is no God. As we can see in, Europe, actually, a lot of people became atheistic because they were, during the wartime, they were sending their children or sons and daughters off to war, and they'll go to churches and pray, oh, please, please, God, protect our children, make sure they come home again, or make sure my husband comes home, or my son comes home from war. And of course, in a lot of circumstances, they were killed, and they did not come home. So a lot of people became atheistic because of this, saying, God, look, I prayed to you for this, and look what you've done to me. You've taken away my spouse, you've taken away my child. Why, God? There is no God. How could you do these things to us? So it is a real challenge, a real test, actually, when distress comes, how we accept that distress. And we can study the point, or study how the kings are accepting this difficulty they've been put through. They're not blaming it upon Krishna, but they're seeing it actually as the Lord's mercy. Actually, you've put us into this distress to save us from this terrible material life, which has made us so despondent. So this is the proper attitude in how a devotee accepts distress. Because a lot of times bhakti yoga is about the consciousness that we're doing things in, the consciousness that we're accepting situations and our circumstances in. So Krishna will put us through tests to see where our consciousness is at. How are we going to accept these things? Are we going to blame Krishna? And a lot of times we can see when devotees are going through difficulties, may blame ISKCON. ISKCON did this to me and they did that to me, and I can't be Krishna conscious because of this and because of that, and this happened and that happened, and blame spiritual masters and blame temple presidents and blame this and blame that. But as Dave Redemarge was explaining very nicely, that people look to these external things around them but don't look at themselves. The kings in this case, they're actually looking at themselves, looking at their position, thinking, yeah, just look at us, we're puffed up, kings, we have so much opulence, we've actually forgotten our position. But now, because of your mercy, Krishna, we understand this material life is actually a very horrible place, and therefore we surrender unto you. Please give us some instruction. So this is the proper attitude to accept things in. And we can learn from this example within our own spiritual lives how to accept distress. And distress will be there. We can see in so many cases devotees may get some sort of terminal illness. We can see with Bhakti Teta Swami was a nice example of how a devotee accepted a very distressful situation. At no time did Bhakti Teta Swami blame Krishna, but he said, this is actually what I've been praying for. Because in 2004, Bhakti Teta Maharaj offered a very nice Vyasa Puja homage to Srila Prabhupada, which is well worth reading, explaining how he's saying, I wish that I could say everything is very nice in your ISKCON. However, there are still so many difficulties. Devotees are struggling in so many ways. So he offered a very wonderful prayer that, please let me take on the suffering of the other devotees. Let me suffer so that ISKCON and devotees can overcome their struggles and progress in their spiritual lives. And it wasn't long after this that Bhakti Teta Maharaj was diagnosed with a form of cancer, which became terminal and ultimately was the cause of his death. But when you read or hear about the whole process that Bhakti Teta Maharaj went through in passing away, is that he always took it as Krishna's mercy, and his consciousness was always that way. That is actually the greatest benediction upon him, that he was going through this death experience in a very public way. Because every day there were different reports coming out of his condition he was in, the interaction he's having with his disciples and God brothers and God sisters, and the attitude in which he's accepting it in. I think he wrote a book in the Beggar series called Die Before Dying. So in this way he's showing the proper attitude and how one should accept death, that one should see it as Krishna's mercy and as a great opportunity to fully surrender one's consciousness to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So obviously this death or dying experience is an experience that all devotees must go through. And as Prabhupada said that, one must fly their own plane. When a plane is on the ground, one can have all good instruction and good advice and mentorship how to fly the plane, but once one is up in the air, one is on their own and must fly the plane on their own. So, in other words, we have to take responsibility for our own spiritual lives to some degree. That we can't expect other people to live our lives for us, that we have to take responsibility, and of course we do that under guidance, so forth, by our authorities and spiritual mentors and so forth. We do it under guidance, but ultimately at the time of death we have to fly our own plane. Unfortunately, someone can't die on our behalf. We have to go through that experience ourselves. So we're practicing and training ourselves up for that time, whenever that time may come. And of course, none of us know when that time may be here. Parikshit Maharaj had the benediction that he knew that he had 7 days left. So he did the intelligent thing and renounced his kingdom. All his attachments and opulences and wealth and prestige, gave them all up and simply went to the bank of Yamuna, found the most qualified person to take guidance from, Shukadev Goswami, accepted him as a spiritual master, and just heard. Shravanam, Ketanam, Vishnu, Smaranam for 7 days straight. So, nice example of how to ready oneself for the time of death. But of course, we don't have the same grace that Maharaj Parikshit had. We don't know when we're going to die. It's the reality of it in the material world. Param, param, yabhi, param, natesham. I like that mantra. Danger at every step in the material world. Param param yavipadam natesham. Danger every step. But for those who have surrendered to the lotus feet of Krishna, then there is no danger. So we should always be in the state of mind that we are developing the right consciousness to leave our bodies in. Because we want to leave our bodies in Krishna consciousness, which means we want to be remembering Krishna at the time of death. Because we know the time of death is very unpleasant. And when I was with David Ramitaswamy down in Ocean Grove, he was showing a DVD, which is it was about old age. He's doing a retreat in New Zealand very soon, and every retreat he shows a certain theme. I haven't actually been to any of his retreats. I suppose some of the Mudajis have been to some of his retreats in New Zealand before. He shows one on death or dying, and this year's theme is on old age. So he's showing this DVD about aging in America, and you can see it's a very For non-devotees, of course, it's a very, very difficult time, old age. That's why Prabhupada says it's one of the miseries, birth, death, old age and disease. So old age is a very, very difficult time in life to be passing through, especially if one hasn't cultivated any spiritual consciousness. And you can see with a lot of these elderly people, the one man was saying, yeah, I don't have anything to look forward to. He's in his 80s, and yeah, I've got nothing to look forward to. No. Most of my family don't want to know me. They've just put me to a rest home. Most of my close friends have all passed away. Yeah, I've got nothing to look forward to. Very, very distressful situation to be in. Very, very, very difficult. So you can see at the time of death, very, very, very fearful because they're heading to an unknown point in their lives. One nurse is commenting that most people think that they will. I think Dave Mediswami is talking about this as well. How a lot of people think that when they die, it'll be very peacefully. They'll be lying in their bed and they will just close their eyes and they'll go to sleep, and this way they'll pass away very peacefully. But this nurse is saying, actually, it's not like that. A very, very small percentage of people pass away in their sleep. So most people, their deaths are very, very drawn out. Like in old age, they get some illness and they have to live with that illness for a period of time, maybe months, maybe years, a long, long time. And all the distress and anxiety that comes along with that. So for a devotee, the death experience is completely different because our consciousness is different. Devotees think and see things differently to non-devotees. The consciousness is very, very, very different, and the death experience is also very different as well. It's because Krishna's grace and Krishna's mercy is there. And if you hear a very nice, wonderful talk that Radhana Swami gave about the passing of Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj, he was with Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj the last 7 weeks of his life. And you can see that Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj was getting a lot of mercy in so many, many wonderful ways, and so much wonderful reciprocation from Krishna and from Srila Prabhupada and from disciples of Srila Prabhupada. So much wonderful reciprocation. You see that his consciousness was taken to another level. His faith became very, very, very deep and was getting a lot of realization. So this is what our whole life is preparing for, through the different phases of life that our body must pass through youth into middle age and then into old age. Now is the time to practice Krishna consciousness, which is why Prahlad Maharaj says that Krishna consciousness should be practiced from a young age, from youth. Practice Krishna consciousness. It's very easy to think, well, I'm young now and I've got plenty of time. Time is on my side. Plenty of time for me to be Krishna conscious later on. Put it off to later on. But very, very foolish if one is thinking that way, because as we're saying, we do not know when death will come. And it's not that at the time of death, suddenly, bam, yep, we'll think of Krishna. Immediate pure devotion. Uttama bhakti at the time of death, no problem. No, now is we have to keep, it's a practice, it is a discipline, which has to be practiced throughout one's life so that one's consciousness is properly focused in the right way at the time of death. And of course, when obstacles do come, when challenges do come, it may be a form of sickness, it may come in the form that we are maybe not getting the things that we'd like to get in spiritual life, that we have to see everything as Krishna's mercy. And it takes a bit of advancement to start developing that way of seeing things as Krishna's mercy. Whatever comes, it is Krishna's mercy in one form or another. So it takes a bit of Krishna consciousness to take things and accept things in this way. Everything is coming by Krishna's mercy. Including the distress, not just the happiness and the sunny days, but also the rainy days and the troubles and difficulties and tribulations are also Krishna's mercy in the long run. It may be really hard to see it that way in the short term, but in the long run, it is easy to see. Krishna's hand was there. I say that hindsight is easier than foresight. So when we are going through difficulties and challenges, not only we have to accept it in the right way, but know the proper course of action to take, what to do when difficulties and challenges come. Which is why it's important to cultivate nice relationships with devotees. It is important, one of the processes that Rupa Goswami has given in the Nectar of Devotion is that the six processes of bhakti is one has to reveal one's mind. So you have to cultivate relationships with people so you can reveal your mind to devotees. Because we don't just reveal our mind to anyone and everyone, but generally we reveal our mind to those who we've cultivated more intimacy with. And we reveal our mind in confidence. So if we are going through difficulties or having some doubts or whatever it may be, we can reveal our mind to people. Because we can see, time and time again, that devotees who don't reveal their mind, if they're having some difficulty, they don't reveal it to anybody, generally they will leave the association of Vaishnavas. And that is the worst thing that can actually happen, is if someone leaves the association of devotees for whatever reason it may be. So it is very important to cultivate relationships with devotees so you can reveal your mind. So there is a culture of how to associate with devotees nicely, and that is for our own protection and our own safety, so we can reveal minds, and also be in a position that if people are revealing their minds to us, knowing how to give help and guidance as well. So very, very important to knowing how to do these things, that when difficulties come, just don't keep it all inside of you. Make sure you reveal your mind, whatever it is you're going through. It's not embarrassing to be going through difficulties. It's not that if you're going through a difficulty that no one's ever gone through it ever before, that you should reveal it. It's for your own welfare and your spiritual life to reveal difficulties you're going through. And don't be too proud or embarrassed to do that. The devotees are not going to not there to laugh at you and think, oh, you're going through that. No, devotees aren't going to do that. It's not what devotee association is about. Devotees are there to, as well wishes to everybody, and the association of devotees is there to help, protect and nurture and inspire the devotees as well. So one of the processes given by Rupa Goswami is to do these things. So do it for your own benefit. It's there for a reason. So in this way, this is also another example of the kings are setting, is that when they were in their material difficulty, they sent one of their messengers out, one of the kings escaped the cave they were within and sent a message to Krishna, please, they revealed their minds. Please, Krishna, help us. What can we do in this situation? We're in great difficulty. Jarasandha has imprisoned us. He's going to offer us as a sacrificial offering to Shiva. We have no other shelter apart from you. Please protect us. Please help us. So the kings were taking shelter of Krishna in a very, very wonderful way. And we can see, what did Krishna do? He reciprocated. He came and helped them. They revealed their mind, and Krishna came to help them in a very, very wonderful way. Krishna personally came. Not that he sent somebody, he could have sent the Pandavas or anyone to kill Jarasandha, but he came personally to save these kings. So this is the personalism of Krishna, that he reciprocates personally with the desire of his devotees and those who take shelter of him. So very, very, very personal. And in such a wonderful way that they had the darshan of his, this very wonderful form, this very wonderful appearance that we're reading about in this text from today. Very, very great mercy that these kings got. And not only that, Krishna gives them very, very wonderful instructions about what to do now. And he personally made sure that they were bathed properly, personally made sure that they were dressed properly, have the proper ornaments of a king. So much wonderful reciprocation going on. So Krishna does like to reciprocate. So it says in the famous verse in the Bhagavatam, akama savakama va mokshukama udaridi, that whether one has desires for liberation, mokshakama, has no material desires or is full of material desires, and one should, in all circumstances, should always approach Krishna, because Krishna knows how to reciprocate in the most perfect way for that person's benefit and that person's purification and advancement in Krishna consciousness. So Krishna is the perfect reciprocator in all circumstances. So very, very wonderful pastime. And we will hear in the coming texts about the wonderful prayers that these kings begin to offer to Lord Krishna, realising their position, because they become very humbled by being put in this position, and also they become very indebted to Krishna. It's like us, if someone helps us out in some difficulty, if we're in some difficult situation and someone helps us in that situation, we feel indebted to that person. Any lady or gentleman will feel indebted and want to reciprocate with someone who helps them out. So in this way, the kings also become very indebted to Krishna. And begin offering very wonderful prayers and become humbled and realise their position. And Krishna will reciprocate very nicely with their prayers and their desires. So we can stop there and ask if there's any points or questions at all from what we were discussing. Any comments, Mahamaji? Yadu Ji.
I find it very difficult to understand if somebody can take the karma. I can understand it from a Christian point of view. That a guru can take
Chaitanya Swami had been very inspired throughout his whole life by Vasudev Dutt. Now, Vasudev Dutt, have you heard the story of Vasudev Dutt? He was one of Lord Chaitanya's associates, and Vasudev Dutt had one time revealed to Lord Chaitanya that that there are so many living entities who are entrapped in the material world, engaged in so many sinful activities. Please let me take on all the sinful reactions of all the living entities in the entire universe, and let me suffer on their behalf so that they all may be liberated. So Prabhupada glorifies Vasudev Dutt as being a very, very exalted Vaishnav in this mentality of accepting the reactions of all the sinful activities in the whole universe. So Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj was very inspired by this example of Vasudev Dutt, and he said that Vasudev Dutt had been a role model for him throughout his devotional life, and he had very much so cultivated this mood, and obviously he was in a level of advancement where he was able to offer this prayer. To make a prayer in that way, to take on the reactions of the suffering of others, is a very, very exalted state of consciousness. So Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj was a very, very exalted, very, very advanced devotee, and he had made that prayer not just to make a show of himself, just seeing how great I am, but he'd offered it in all sincerity. So whether that was the cause of his illness or sickness, who's to say? But Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj did reveal that when he was very, very ill, that and Radhanath Swami also reveals that it was in this lecture he gave in Chalpati how Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj was able to actually help so many devotees, and even Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj said that himself, that in the position I'm in, that I'm able to help so many devotees who are struggling. Like, so many devotees had left the movement and were going through so many difficulties, were coming to Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj and were revealing their minds to him. And Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj was, like Radhanath Swami was saying, was just completely empowered at that time just to speak the very profound, very deep, very heart-penetrating words to these devotees. And a lot of them came back to Krishna consciousness because of Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj being in the situation he was in. So definitely there's some arrangement going on there by Krishna's hand to put Bhakti Chaitanya Maharaj in that position where he was able to help out so many devotees who were struggling, who had left the movement, and he was giving shelter to so many devotees in such a wonderful way. So Krishna's hand was definitely there on some level. Yeah, but Prabhupada, actually interesting, Prabhupada said that Vasudev Dutt was even more exalted than Jesus Christ, because Vasudev Dutt wanted to take on the reaction of all the whole universe, whereas Jesus said just for those who surrender to him. So you can see very, very exalted consciousness. And I did make a statement that there's more to hell, but you do not have the ears to hear these things. So yeah, I mean, you understand. You know, it's time, place and circumstance.
Yes,
yeah.
Prabhupada also said that as a spiritual master, sometimes he experienced bad dreams from taking on the reactions of his disciples.
Mm.
So that the disciples get initiation, it's not that the karma is sort of like 100% kind of wiped out, but they don't have a great responsibility not to perform further sinful activities and put more, because the simple people might go through a little bit of suffering in terms of initiating the disciple. Prabhupada said himself that he hit someone some of the bad dreams and taking disciples. The other point with Bhakti Chaitanya Swami, because he was born as a black person in America at a time when black persons were heavily discriminated against. So he knew from childhood someone what it was like for people who were kind of downtrodden, and therefore he was always looking for people in his family who may have been downtrodden for whatever reason. Their perhaps the karma wasn't terribly together, or they didn't rise to big positions, and he was trying to inspire them and encourage them like that. But he knew what sort of what life was like from a situation where you're not born very, and his father left when he was very young, and born a black person in America, heavily discriminated against blacks up to about 60 or 70. So he often was the person in ISKCON who knew what it was like to really be downtrodden. Because that's many of the leaders in ISKCON, they came from kind of like middle class background. They perhaps didn't know what it was like to sort of be at the bottom, discriminated against, and oppressed like that. So in that sense, one of the great aspects of his service was that he looked for people in ISKCON who perhaps were downtrodden and tried to inspire them in Christian consciousness.
Yeah, very, very, very inspiring devotee. like was it Prahlad Mahara says that the mood of a Vaishnava is paradukuduki, a devotee is unhappy to see the unhappiness of others. So that's the sort of consciousness. If we want to go back to the spiritual realm, we have to cultivate this consciousness that we actually feel compassion for the suffering of others, not just worry about our own advancement in our own little scene, but we actually have to cultivate a greater, broader consciousness, being concerned about the welfare of others as well. And through, obviously through Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement, we're able to do that through book distribution, through Harinam distribution, through Prasadam distribution, so many other ways we're able to spread the mercy and compassion to all living entities. So I'm very fortunate. Okay.
As you said, especially when Srila Prabhupada, his compassion was so great. When he was passing near Richmond, you know, he saw a lot of people just running around for watching the matches and this and that. So Srila Prabhupada had tears in his eyes in the car, and devotees observed those, and then Prabhupada said, look, how they are wasting their life. Mm. Human life is meant only for getting the God consciousness, and if we are not doing that, we are all wasting time. So you can see how much care Prabhupada took in bringing this ISKCON to this stage that we all can meet and converse together and discuss everything. So this is what we have to see. And of course we all are advancing in old age, and particularly, so we have to prepare for that. And the best thing is to improve our chanting in such a nice way, pure chanting, that Krishna can easily take us back to your station. That's how we can pray. And seeing compassion of Prabhupada, we have to see that we all should be compassionate towards everyone, all the materialists, so that they can also come to the movement and take some benefit. Even if they can't, they can get some prasadam and get the benefit. At least they can get a human life next time, and then they can do this. That's my view. You gave a wonderful class.
Thank you. Thank you, Papaji. Any more questions or points at all then?
I just want to know, I was thinking about these miseries caused by the right attitude, which you have seen. It appears to me that the miseries caused because of ill health or because of nature, those circumstances are easier for us to understand and tolerate, but the miseries caused by other people, other living entities, it appears like why should it be? So it seems to me that there's a difference in the way we tolerate. And the tolerance is more there, that we have to put in more effort on
that.
Well,
it's also explained in the Maha, I think in the Shastra, that one way we get our reactions is through other living entities. So sometimes we, interacting with other living entities, we're receiving our karmas through another living entity in one way or another. Yeah. So that may be there. You know, in the past life we've done something to somebody, and in this life the tide's turned and it's against us. So yeah, it's intricate, very intricate how it happens, but a lot of time is how we respond to it as well. We might be put in a situation where someone's antagonising us and doing something to us because of whatever reason, so it's how we respond is very important as well, how we respond to those situations. And Krishna's a super soul in the heart, and he knows what we're doing and knows how we're responding, so he's watching these things. So we read the qualities of a devotee is that they are equipoised in happiness and distress. So a devotee tries to be equipoised, not affected by one extreme or the other, remaining equipoised, which isn't so easy. It's easier said than done, but yeah, it's a consciousness we're trying to cultivate, and honour and dishonour, fame and infamy, is being equipoised, not affected by these things. Yeah. Easier said than done, of course.
As you said, our consciousness is always devoted towards Krishna only, the devotee, to serve him and serve the devotees. That should be it.
Of course, at the same time, doesn't mean a devotee does not get angry. A devotee uses anger and those things in Krishna's service. Like there's one time when Prabhupada was doing a DT installation in Europe, and the devotees had made a bit of a mess of the whole thing, and it was being filmed by television crews and media were there, and Prabhupada was getting very, very, very angry. And how's the story go? Was that the time when one of the disciples said, why are you getting angry for?
Yeah,
and he's getting, and I think one of his disciples said, Prabhupada, just chant Hare Krishna, and Prabhupada said, yes, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna. Because sometimes people think, oh, a sadhu doesn't get angry, but Prabhupada would have those emotions, but they would be in Krishna's service. Not if someone said something horrible to Prabhupada, but if someone was not doing things appropriately in Krishna's service, and Prabhupada would be angry. So it was all emotion is there, but it's used in Krishna's service, not for the egocentric purpose that emotions are usually used for, usually based around some sort of egocentric, selfish thing. Yeah? So emotions are there in bhakti, but they're used in Krishna's service.
Yeah. Like Lord Hanuman.
Used as anger, burned down Lanka. Yes, nice example. Yeah.
The material adjustments don't work. I read last night Bhaktivinoda Gaur saying that sometimes people advocate for just being selfless, like just giving myself to others.
Mm.
And he said, but then what happens is you get surrounded by people who are selfish. They think, oh, here's somebody who's going to give everything to me. And so when you're surrounded by all these people who are selfish, they want to take something from you.
Right.
So he made the point that there's these sort of material adjustments are futile.
Right.
And there's when you ask about the miseries of all the unities,
Aryamic miseries.
These are meant to also teach us to become detached. That's part of the lesson. Mm. Three types of miseries. You're surrounded by other people who have their own agendas. And even deciding to be selfish, but you're still being surrounded by some people who are selfish. You're such a friend of Krishna. And therefore, so sometimes the devotee may chastise. But that's meant to help the person improve their consciousness, to point out. And also, sometimes they may speak kind of firmly. Speak straight, but that's actually meant to help the rathas, but we're going to be nice to everybody all the time. Sometimes there's a need to point things out in a sort of sharp way. But based on a deep level of understanding of Krishna consciousness, not just based on some sort of interruption of sense verification.
Mm. Mm. Nice point. What was the question? Uddhava?
Mm-hmm.
Where does he fit into this?
Yes.
Yeah, at the time that the... it was during when Krishna was in his palace, in his assembly hall, and one of the kings had approached, who had escaped from Jarasandha's cave, had approached Krishna to ask for help, and as this messenger was relaying this to Krishna, Narada Muni appeared on the scene and said, "Oh, you should go to Indraprastha so Samara Yudhisthira can perform his Rajasuya sacrifice." So then there's a dilemma, what to do? We need to save these kings. At the same time, we need to go to Indraprastha to perform the Rajasuya sacrifice. So Uddhava said, well, if you go to kill Jarasandha, then both these things will take place. Jarasandha will be subjugated, you can free the kings, and therefore the Rajasuya sacrifice can take place. So this is all going on because of Uddhava's instruction.
Right.
He's a devotee of Krishna. Yeah. He's a pure devotee, yeah. One of the exalted devotees. Especially if you're just asking a situation of someone, another devotee treats you maybe in a way which you feel a bit hurt by, what do? We just take it as Krishna's mercy that they're being mean to us, that helps become attached, or do we do something, be straightforward with the person? I always advocate it's best to be maybe straightforward and honest with the people and just say, oh, look, Prabhu, you said this thing to me and it made me feel this way. Is everything all right with you? And did I do something to upset you? And so forth. So it's generally best to clear the air, especially if you're living with devotees as well. Nothing worse than you're trying to living in the same house as devotees, and you've got this whole thing going with another devotee, and it's this friction going on, and you don't talk to each other, and there's horrible stares going on. It's very unpleasant. So it's best to clear the air, and if some mediation is required, then you know what a mediation is, where you have someone else who can come in. I mean, sometimes it depends on the circumstances, how serious the situation is. But sometimes you can deal with yourself and be straightforward and clear the air, or else if a mediation is required, it's best to do these things than hold grudges. In fact, it's offensive to be like that towards devotees. So when you see a devotee, you should be happy and joyful to see another Vaishnava, not this, not you again. So Yeah. So it's best to take the appropriate means to deal with the situation, whether it's in the form of a mediation, and there aren't qualified mediators in this temple to deal with those situations, or else if you can just speak with them privately and do it that way. So some sort of mediation is required. Offer obeisances. But best to deal with it. Don't let it linger. It's nothing worse than having a whole thing going on with another devotee. It's very unpleasant, very disturbing, and it's offensive too. So any more questions or points at all? Grandhara Srimad Bhagavatam Ki, Shri Prabhupada Ki.